Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This started a long life of group homes, detention centers, and ultimately prison.
At what point did they intervene? Why didn't they intervene?
It's a situation that I would not want to find myself in. I would never want to get attacked, and I would never want to have to defend myself by killing somebody.
And the big question we always ask, John, is justice been served here?
This is True Crime Cast.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie back in the studio with John for the first time in weeks.
Yeah, we recorded a ton of episodes so that we could both have a small vacation. We'll fill you in on those vacations over on Bless Their Hearts, but man, we got a lot of catching up to do.
We do. It's been a good break for me, a good chance to kind of regroup and do a little bit more investigation and writing. And we also have a lot of thank yous to give out for people who have supported the show since the last time that we recorded.
All right, I'll take off if you don't care. We've got Cece, who came in at the $7 level over on Patreon. Also on Patreon, Justin came in at the $10 level and took advantage of that yearly annual discount of 15%. David Roberts did the same thing at $3 level. Melissa did a $10 a month Patreon membership. So Melissa gets a special shout out from Jamie.
Melissa, we really appreciate your support. It's individuals like you that keep this show going, and we really appreciate that. You're high quality, Melissa. I think Justin came in at the $10 level too, right? So Justin gets a special shout out.
Yeah, my bad.
They also get autographs of us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Justin, we greatly appreciate you and love the frugal ability to take advantage of that discount.
Yeah. And I will be sending those out in the mail this week that you're listening to this. And last, certainly not least, we have Alyssa from Canada, came in at the $3 level. So Alyssa, thank you all so much.
We have a few people who sent in some 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. This one says, great show. Harlan County in here found your show through the sharing of your episode on Kayla Massengale. I hope her family gets justice. That episode was heartbreaking. That's from Mama 342922. I want to say that Kayla's case is still ongoing. Haven't had a big break yet, but they're getting really close to their fundraising goal. So go over to Facebook and search for Justice for Kayla for ways to get involved with some reward money over there. This comes from Marissa Thompson. Says, a new fave. This has quickly become one of my favorite podcasts that I listen to and look forward to each week. They are great storytellers, keep with the facts, but putting a spin on all the cases that really makes you visualize and feel for these victims and their families. I'll never miss an episode. I'm currently binging all the episodes I haven't heard yet. Keep it up, guys. Take care. Thank you to Marissa for that. Last but not least, Jen J. Mack. These guys are the best. Listening to John and Jamie's like hanging out with my best friends and talking about crime. They are great together, not afraid to disagree, and are able to keep the episodes factual while adding bits of humor to make the experience light. After a heavy episode, I switch over to their other podcast, Bless Their Hearts, to lighten my mood. That podcast is a very entertaining one. Has justice been served? They will give you the facts to decide. Thank you so much, Jen, for that one. So we are reading these 5-star reviews, whether they come in on social media or over on Apple Podcasts. That's really the best way that you can support our show to make it more visible to others.
Guys, we really appreciate you all for everything you do. But without further ado, let's get the ball rolling, man.
Yeah, this is a wild ride. I've never heard of this case before, but my goodness, buckle up. John, what do you got?
All right, we're going to go back to July 27th, 2008. Man, those were good years. I was young. I didn't have like the extra weight on me yet. I was still in my prime.
Yeah.
But anyway, July 27th, 2008, Sandra Boss was in her suite at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston when she was told that her ex-husband had abducted their 7-year-old daughter. Not a phone call anyone would want to get. Sandra was a Harvard Business School graduate and senior partner at a global management consulting firm. She had been married to a man named Clark Rockefeller. That's a pretty powerful name, right?
Yeah, certainly associated with success and wealth. Rockefellers can do whatever they want, right?
Unfortunately, like I said, on that day, she found out that he may be responsible for the kidnapping of their daughter. So she thought his name was Clark Rockefeller and that that was who she had built her life with. But when she left him in 2006, she discovered that he'd made up his name and his entire life. So when Boston police entered Rockefeller's name into their national databases, they didn't find anything. When they asked Sondra about her husband's accounts, like her cell phone and identification papers, she had nothing for him because he was living a lie.
Now let's go back over what investigators found when they really started digging into the life of Clark Rockefeller. For the sake of simplicity, we'll refer to him as Clark or Rockefeller throughout this story, but he was actually born Christian Karl Gerheitzer in 1961 in Bergen, West Germany. He was a misfit. He was short, skinny. He was really fantastical and had a great imagination, but that made him not fit in as much with his peers. His father was a house painter and an amateur artist, and his mother was a seamstress. Rockefeller was always making up stories, making up identities, and being really creative with who he was and who he wanted to be. When he was 17 years old, he was on a train where he met a family from America. He charmed them, and the family told him that if he ever moves to the United States, he should look them up and spend the night with them. So he thought, this is an open invitation to go to the States.
Is that like one of those offers that you make thinking that they would never take you up on it?
Absolutely. I think people do that all the time. They're like, oh, let me know when you come by, knowing it'll never happen, but be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, he didn't take it that way. This sounded actually like a very attractive offer to Rockefeller. So he set off to America. He told immigration authorities that he had a place to stay with the family that he met on the train. He showed up on the family's doorstep and was actually welcomed for a short time. Rockefeller posted an ad for lodging in the local paper claiming to be a foreign exchange student who wanted to take a place to stay while finishing high school in the States. Edward Savio responded and offered their place to the teenager. Rockefeller then enrolled in Berlin High School, now using the name Christopher Gerheitzer Ryder. And he started wearing tight European clothing. He grew his hair long, and he told everybody that his father was a wealthy industrialist with Mercedes.
During his time with their family, Rockefeller slept on the Savio's couch. Every day he woke up, he expected breakfast to be prepared and his clothes to be clean and laid out for him. Not something I would think about for a young adult, especially staying at somebody else's house. But he made it clear to that family that their lifestyle was not up to his standards. In my opinion, if I'm hosting somebody at my house and my lifestyle is not up to their standards, then they can probably find somewhere else to live. And eventually the Savios reached their breaking point with Rockefeller. He refused to get up from the couch to unlock the door for the family's young daughter to come in. And this is in the middle of winter, and she's outside trying to get in the house with her key, and he just let her stay out there. That's when the family finally kicked him out of the house and Clark Rockefeller was looking for his next place to stay.
So by the time the Savios asked him to leave, Rockefeller was going by Chris Kenneth Gerhart. I mean, I'm having a hard time keeping up with all the different names here.
Yeah, it's almost like he's making a slow transition into this Rockefeller persona. But yeah, a lot of different names being thrown out. He reinvents himself so often.
It reminds me of the movie, and you're going to have to help me think of the name of it, but where Leonardo DiCaprio has multiple personalities, multiple jobs.
That reminded me, this case reminded me of that as well. That's Frank Abagnale. The movie is Catch Me If You Can, a case that we've covered. And that also is a true story of somebody who is a con person and continues to make up different personas. And as long as they're confident, they usually get what they want.
Yeah. So he left that family's home and he made his way to the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. There he started studying film. He also decided that it was time for him to get his citizenship. In 1981, the 20-year-old married 22-year-old Amy Dunkeith in Madison, Wisconsin. He convinced Amy to marry him by telling her that if he didn't get a green card, he'd have to go back to West Germany. He told her that he'd be forced to join the military and be sent to fight in the Cold War on the Russian front line. So he tried to gain her sympathy, and it worked out. Several weeks after the wedding, Rockefeller got his green card, but he left his wife and stopped showing up for classes. So he moved to Los Angeles to get into the film business, and Amy eventually filed for divorce in 1992.
Yeah, this is one of those, I don't know if classic or stereotypical green card marriages where somebody gets married just to keep another individual in the country. I assume that this happens less and less now, just based on the government's knowledge of it being a prominent thing that goes on, and the government being able to look at social media and find out that, no, you're not really with this person. Do you get that assumption as well, or do you think it's still a prominent issue?
I don't really know. I mean, I've definitely seen like a bunch of movies based on the premise, but I don't know that I've ever encountered any of those situations in real life, but I'm sure it does happen.
Yeah, I'm sure it still happens. I would think not as much, but I could be off on that. Once he gets to the West Coast, Rockefeller started calling himself Christopher Chichester.
That's a tongue twister.
That is. I think I'd choose something easier and something that stands out less if I'm going to try to continue to change my name. But of course, he ends up at Rockefeller, which is a name that nobody's going to forget. He stole this name from one of his high school teachers when he was living back in the Northeast when he first got to America. Ironically, Rockefeller didn't like all the fake people in LA, and that was his reason for moving to San Marino.
That's an odd reason, you know?
Yeah.
I know opposites attract, so I guess if you're around a lot of people who are also fake, I guess you just really don't like it.
Yeah, he did not like people pretending to be somebody else, which is what his entire life at this point was based on. He was a regular at local businesses and social clubs where he would go around and smooth talk people to get free lunches. He also attended prominent churches where he could easily crash wedding buffets, crash parties. He spent a lot of time in the library improving his English speaking skills and learning everything that he could about business and about gaining wealth. He eventually learned to be a socialite by charming elderly widows around town. He started handing out business cards for what he called the Chichester Family Crest. His story grew to include being a member of the royal family in England. So it seems like his lying knows no bounds. And after we get back from the break, we'll talk about the web of lies that ultimately brought Rockefeller down.
Rockefeller told people that he was working towards his master's in film. Meanwhile, Rockefeller was living rent-free in a guest house behind the house of Ruth Sohaus, and she goes by Dee Dee. Dee Dee was well known as reclusive, she was an alcoholic, and Rockefeller was able to take full advantage of her until her son, John, moved in. Now, John was kind of a geek. He was in his 20s with a low-level job in Pasadena. He brought his wife, Linda, with him. So there's a lot of names being thrown around. There's Dee Dee, who's letting Rockefeller live rent-free. And then John moves in, and he brings his wife, Linda. So hopefully you're all with me here. He didn't trust Rockefeller, so he started asking questions about how Rockefeller appeared to be using his mother's money for expensive clothes. In 1985, John and Linda told friends they were going to New York for 2 weeks. But after 8 weeks went by, Linda's sister called Dee Dee to find out where the couple was. Dee Dee told Linda's sister that John and Linda had moved to Europe on a top secret mission for the government.
Yeah.
A little weird, right?
Yeah, I feel like there are a lot of excuses to make up for why people are gone. But I think if I know a couple or if I know an individual to be just an average citizen, the government sending them on a mission is not something I'm going to readily accept.
Yeah, and Linda told her sister that they were going to New York for just a couple of weeks. And then here we are 8 weeks later. And Dee Dee's like, I don't know. I think they moved to Paris on a top secret mission. That's so weird. Now, when police got involved because Linda's sister called the police, Dee Dee assured them that she was getting updates from a trusted source. I'm sure you can imagine who that source was. 5 months after the couple disappeared, Dee Dee stopped hearing from her source. That would be Rockefeller. And she did end up filing a missing person report for the couple. But I mean, substantial amount of time went by before this was done.
Yeah, at this point, you're 5-6 months in, and we talk often about the importance of the first 48 hours. At this point, the trail is very, very cold. Fast forward 9 years later in 1994, and a new family lived in Dee Dee's house and started digging a pool in the backyard. The crew working on the project ran into an interesting discovery when they were flattening the area for the pool and they were digging. They found skeletal remains buried in Dee Dee's backyard. Obviously, with two individuals having gone missing from that house nearly a decade earlier, it was pretty clear who these skeletal remains belonged to. John had been adopted, so there was no way to test the DNA of the bones against Dee Dee's family to see if John was who he said he was. But they did say that the bones would match John's general description.
Wasn't he also wearing clothes that his family remembered that he always wore?
Right.
Like a plaid shirt and jeans.
Which it's always amazing to me. Sometimes when we discover remains like this, some things are preserved and some are not, depending on the environment that they're in. The fact that the clothes lasted that long has always been fascinating to me.
It makes me think of the Lake Mead situation where the body was found in the barrel. The clothes was preserved, so they were able to say, these clothes were bought at Sears between these years.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So apparently there's no Sears around anymore, but if you want good lasting clothes, check them out. Not a sponsor.
They've found even more stuff in Lake Mead since we covered that case, but I digress. Forensic evidence did show that the victim that was found in Dee Dee's former backyard had been struck in the head two times with a rounded, blunt object and then stabbed six times. His body had been cut up into three parts. Now, these bones weren't determined to be John Sohas until 2010.
Back in 1985, when the couple disappeared, people immediately started questioning Rockefeller. One neighbor said Rockefeller borrowed a chainsaw from him around the same time that John and Linda were leaving for New York. So that kind of seems sinister, doesn't it? This was weird since Edward Savio, the family Rockefeller first stayed with, said Rockefeller had never picked up a f-ing tool in his life.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Like, what does this dude need a chainsaw for if he doesn't know how to use it, right? Investigators also talked to Rockefeller's friend, Dana. She told them that he went over to Rockefeller's one day after the disappearance to play Trivial Pursuit, which was a pretty common game. So the two were playing that. Dana said the whole yard was dug up, and Rockefeller told her that he was having some plumbing problems. Before he left town, Rockefeller went for one last haircut where he told his hairdresser that a family member of his dad's had died in England and he had to go back to take care of the estate. He left town in a pickup truck that belonged to John and Linda.
So to recap, he's moved in with Dee Dee, lives there rent-free, and when her son and his wife move in, he kills them, covers it up by saying they went on a secret mission to Europe, and then leaves town in their truck.
Until then, we don't know that he's ever killed anybody, so you wonder if the motive was he was starting to get questions asked about spending Dee Dee's money. Started pissing him off.
Absolutely. This is the first time we see that type of violence, even though we know how dishonest he has been in pretty much every way. Then we go to 1988, and Rockefeller had found his way to Greenwich, Connecticut. He was now going by the name Christopher C. Crow. So there's some continuity here, even though he's not found his way to be Rockefeller just yet. He told people he was a television producer from L.A. who had worked on the 1980s revival of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Somehow, Rockefeller was hired by a brokerage firm called S.N. Phelps & Company. Now, it's worth noting that there was a Christopher Crow that was named in the credits of that series. Obviously, this was not Rockefeller, but by just putting that name out there, it gave him a little bit of credibility. But he was hired specifically to work with computers, noting his experience and expertise in that area. But he was frequently found in the trading room just talking about his life, talking about making movies, and showing himself to be a fraud in that he was not really that good with computers. And I think this is what separates Rockefeller here from Frank Abagnale. Frank Abagnale really passed the board exams for law. He really was able to fly a plane. He really was intelligent and had these skills, but Rockefeller does not seem to have that. He told people that he had a mom and a sister that were living in Paris in a mansion. He seemed to be getting away with all of it until the company ran his social security number And John, this is the biggest mind-blowing piece of this entire case, in my opinion. So we know he's using a fake name. We find out he's using a fake Social Security number to gain employment and open accounts and that kind of thing. This number came back as the number of David Berkowitz, who, if you remember, is the son of Sam, serial killer. It's amazing to me that we see these two criminals committing these different crimes and their lives intersect in this way. But I guess, you know, if he's using a fake number, it had to go back to somebody. It's just the fact that it's fascinating it went back to Berkowitz.
I tried to find it. I'm curious to find out how he got that Social Security number. Like, that's not a coincidence. Like, he found it. I just don't know how.
See, I just assumed he put down random numbers and it just worked out that way.
Yeah, see, I think he found it somehow. But you would think in, you know, in, I guess, his mind in 1988, there's not a huge computer operating system, you know, so it had to be new technology that they were able to plug that number in and it came back in their database. So technology turned out to be a good thing, but like I guess they fired him after that. So kudos to them. So he jumped around to a few more companies until he found out Connecticut state troopers were searching for him. Rockefeller tried to sell John's truck to a local minister's son. When the police received the paperwork, they began looking for the seller, and Rockefeller went underground again, trying to be elusive, and it's working.
It is, and you wonder how much of this is intelligence and savvy, and how much of this is him just getting lucky. But this is when we finally see the birth of his final fake identity, Clark Rockefeller. This is when he goes to New York City, he gets an apartment on 57th Street, and he vows to never go back to Connecticut and revisit those connections again. Rockefeller told everybody that he was a descendant of Percy Rockefeller, of course, the brother of John Rockefeller, who is the Rockefeller, right? He played up the rich, eccentric character, always acting paranoid about security, walking around with a radio device that he claimed was connected to a security team that was responsible for ensuring his safety. And as this persona of Clark Rockefeller, he was able to make a lot of important connections. None of them were as important as his connection to Julia Boss. She was smart, attractive, stylish, and the twin sister of Sandra Boss. Julia asked Rockefeller if he wanted to be set up, and he responded by throwing a party for Sandra. It would be a Clue-themed party for him to meet this lady for the first time. So if you're not familiar with Clue, people show up as characters and there's a murder mystery element to it. And Rockefeller dressed as Professor Plum and Sandra was Miss Scarlet. They hit it off immediately. This is a very creative way to meet somebody. This is probably a really fun event. And for Rockefeller to be playing this role of Professor Plum, he's playing a role every day of his life. He is very...
He's good at it. He's well practiced by this time.
Yeah, he's very fake. You don't know what is genuine about this individual at this point.
And I mean, honestly, our writer Mackenzie put this in there that she would love it. And I think this was so much fun. Like, I would totally do something like this. Sandra told her friends Rockefeller was the brightest man she'd ever met. He knew obscure literature and spoke about several languages, or spoke in several languages, including Star Trek's Klingon, which is awesome.
Is it? Has that ever been cool?
For a nerd like me, sure. Okay. The two were married in 1995 in a Quaker ceremony. He told Sandra that his mom, who was a child star, Ann Carter, had died in a car crash. He also told that all the Rockefellers were invited, but at the last minute there were issues and he uninvited all of them. That's pretty strange. Sandra signed all the necessary documents, but Rockefeller never filed them. The honeymoon didn't last, though. Soon, Rockefeller became emotionally abusive and controlling.
You know, he's starting to remind me of the movie The Wedding Crashers, where they do a little bit of research about the genealogy of the couples to show up that they're related to somebody and to try to fit in and make a connection. And here he made this connection with Sandra, but they never actually were legally married. And it wasn't long after their ceremony that he ended up having an altercation with a different woman in Central Park while they were walking their dog. Police came to the apartment to speak with Rockefeller, and shortly after that, he told Sandra that he didn't want to live in Manhattan anymore. So they ended up moving to Cornish, New Hampshire. Rockefeller told people there that they chose Cornish because it was halfway between Sandra's job in Boston and his company, which was located in Canada. And on May 23rd of 2001, Clark Rockefeller's life changed forever. He and Sandra welcomed baby girl Ray Storo Mills Rockefeller, and he nicknamed his little girl Snooks. Police would later say that his love for his daughter was the only real thing that Rockefeller ever had, and everything else is proven to be a fraud. So I asked a few minutes ago, what's genuine about this individual? And it seems like he really did care for his daughter, which is ultimately going to leave us in a place to where he gets in the most trouble.
Rockefeller seemed completely devoted to his little girl. He homeschooled her until she was ready to go to kindergarten. Sandra insisted that Snooks go to school to be around other children, and I kind of like Sandra agree that's a really important thing. She was accepted at Southfield School for Girls in Boston, right next to Dexter's Boys School where JFK went, so pretty famous place. So the Rockefeller family moved to Boston, also Jamie's favorite city. Rockefeller remained a stay-at-home dad while Sandra brought in a pretty nice salary, six figures, in fact, which barely supported the family's lifestyle. Every morning, she walked Snooks to her bus stop, and once she was on her way, she'd go to the Starbucks down the street to meet with high-profile lawyers, Harvard researchers, and other successful business people. When Snooks wasn't in school, she was with her dad. They walked through the Beacon Hill together, ate at restaurants together, and read books for hours. She seemed to be a carefree, happy little girl. But Rockefeller loved his little girl so much that he refused to discipline her for anything that she did negatively. When Sandra and Rockefeller went to a parent-teacher conference, he refused to take any advice. When they got home, Sandra confronted him, and the two had a very big disagreement on how to raise their daughter. She soon served Rockefeller with divorce papers. And if he is actually devoted to his daughter this much, then this would be devastating news for him.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's great that he loves his daughter that much, but love has to take a lot of different forms, and discipline is a part of that. So now not only is he faced with the possibility of losing his daughter, but also being cut off from his only income source, his wife. Now, I mentioned earlier that he claimed that his office was in Canada. It turns out that he would tell Sandra that he was a part of a business that consulted with low-income countries to build an economy. However, anytime she asked about money or what he was being paid, he often would come back with, "They didn't have enough money to pay us. We're really just doing this to support these people." So again, making up a big lie about why he's not making any money. So he ended up asking people to buy back antique cars that he had bought from them, and he tried to sell some of their massive art collection just to get some money. He told everybody that his wife took him for everything and that she only ever married him for his money, which he never had any of. But Sandra got a good attorney, and her dad, William, decided to investigate Rockefeller and find all the dirt that they could on him for the pending litigation. He and other family members suspected that Rockefeller was siphoning off money from Sandra and then hiding the money from her. The first thing that William did was look on Wikipedia to check out Rockefeller's late mother, child star Ann Carter. Rockefeller had claimed that she had died in a car crash, but as it turns out, Ann Carter was very much alive at the time.
Do your homework, bro. If you're going to make up some crap,
absolutely,
make sure it's legit.
He found more inconsistencies the more he looked into Rockefeller's stories, and Sandra started wondering what else her ex-husband had lied to her about, and who is this guy really?
Yeah, so she did what most people would do, and she hired a private investigator. But Rockefeller couldn't risk being found out, so he gave Sandra everything she wanted in the divorce. She got the house in New Hampshire and Boston. He even agreed to sign over his parental rights to Snooks in exchange for $800,000. So I question, does he really love this little girl?
Right. That's tough. If he does want his parental rights, obviously this is part of the negotiation of who gets what and the custody negotiation. And not only does this make me question his devotion to his daughter, but what's the tipping point there? What's the dollar amount with which you're willing to sell your parental rights?
That's crazy. I've never heard of anything like that. So the judge granted Sandra the right to move to London with her daughter, and this also included giving Rockefeller 3 court-supervised visits each year. So it didn't take long for Rockefeller to start planning on how to get his daughter back. So maybe he was actually devoted.
Maybe he was, and that I find that interesting as well. If there was no abuse or no history of mental disability, why are these court-supervised visits, John? I know you work in a world where kids are separated from their parents often, and they do get visits, which are often supervised. It just baffles me why these would be supervised visits, unless there's just something we don't know about.
Yeah, I think there's probably more that we don't know about, but I mean, he was living a lie, and he was being found out, so maybe the courts took that into consideration.
Now we're caught up back to the sunny day in July when Snooks went missing. Rockefeller left his room at Boston's Aliquin Club carrying Snooks on his shoulders. They were on their way to ride swan boats in the Boston Commons public garden. The appointed social worker was tagging closely behind, and as they were talking, a black SUV limo pulled up to the curb. Rockefeller had previously hired this driver, telling him where and when to meet. He said that he and Snooks had a lunch date, and that he may need help getting rid of a clingy friend who might try to get into the limo. The driver, who had been paid $3,000 for this trip, promised that nobody would get into that car without Rockefeller's consent. As the SUV pulled up, in one quick move, Rockefeller pushed the social worker away, opened the door, and pulled his daughter into the car with him, ultimately banging her head on the door frame as she was being pulled in. He shouted, "Go, go, go," at the driver, and he stepped on the gas. The social worker actually held on to the back door handle and was dragged before letting go and ultimately coming to rest on the pavement. This is kidnapping, 100% in every sense of the word, even if this is your daughter, correct, John?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, he's breaking a court order, so this is not going to be good for him. So soon, Rockefeller told the driver to pull over so he could get out of the taxi and go to the hospital. He claimed he wanted to get Snook's head checked out before where she had bumped it. He actually took the cab to Boston Sailing Center, where a friend was waiting to drive them to New York in a car for $500. When they got into Manhattan, they hit traffic, which I would assume you always do when you hit Manhattan. Rockefeller picked up Snook's, threw an envelope of money into the front seat, and then ran off without a goodbye. So, of course, this triggered, and a warrant was issued with custodial kidnapping, assault, and battery for the assault on the social worker. This, of course, started a massive manhunt for these two. It was actually a 5-day long chase, and there were police officers and FBI were involved. It was a massive ordeal.
Investigators got a break in their search when a real estate agent in Baltimore recognized Rockefeller's picture on television. She called the FBI and told them that she had sold that man a house and he had paid her in cashier's checks. She said the buyer went by Chip Smith.
Of course he did.
And he had a daughter named Muffy. So now he is coming up with even more ridiculous names and forcing this onto his daughter. He told her he was a ship captain relocating from Chile. Investigators got the manager of a nearby marina to call Rockefeller and tell him that his recently bought catamaran was taking on water. Rockefeller rushed out to check on his boat, leaving his daughter behind. 20 agents with assault rifles were waiting for Rockefeller when he got to the marina. They wrestled him to the ground while others went to the house and got Snooks out safely. She was thankfully unharmed in this apprehension. Once Sandra had finally gotten on the phone and was able to talk to Snooks and found out she was safe, she turned to agents and said, "Who is he?" She had had enough of Rockefeller's fraud, his lies, and his efforts to seemingly take her daughter away.
So during this trial, because of course this went to trial, Rockefeller's defense told the jurors that he believed his daughter had communicated with him telepathically from London and begged him to come rescue her. I mean, he's done some crazy stuff, but this might be one of the craziest things I've ever heard.
Yeah, most of what he said has at least been believable enough to convince some people, but this is absurd.
2 expert witnesses testified Rockefeller had been diagnosed with delusional disorder, grandiose type and narcissistic personality disorder. But one expert said that Rockefeller was exaggerating his symptoms and knew right from wrong. He also pointed out that Rockefeller had meticulously planned the abduction in advance. So on June 8th, 2009, Rockefeller was convicted of kidnapping his daughter and assault and battery on the social worker. He was sentenced to 7 years in prison.
I feel like that's a low sentence for kidnapping, but that's where we are. Also, the meticulous planning to get in so many different vehicles to throw off anybody that would be tracking him, that's some Italian Jobs type stuff there. But things weren't over for Rockefeller. If you remember earlier, we talked about John Sohus's bones being found and later identified in 2010. In March of 2011, Los Angeles County prosecutors charged Rockefeller with the Sohus's murder. He ended up being convicted of first-degree murder in 2013 on mostly circumstantial evidence, including the fact that Rockefeller had been in possession of the truck following the murder. For these crimes, he was sentenced to 27 years in prison. He fired his attorneys and represented himself in sentencing, trying to get a lesser sentence, where he maintained that he was innocent and that John's wife, Linda, must have killed him.
So, I mean, back to Linda, we know that John's remains were found, but anything from Linda?
Not that we know of. That's an excellent question there, because that would have seemingly been an easier DNA match than John since he was adopted. But he's only been convicted here of John's murder. In December of 2016, he was transferred to San Quentin, where he will be eligible for parole in December of 2029, as long as he has good behavior. So from his final sentencing in 2013, he's only going to serve 16 years of that 27-year sentence for murder, an additional 7-year sentence for kidnapping, before he is able to be eligible for parole. Not that that would be automatic.
Rockefeller spoke with the Boston Globe from a Boston jail. He was unapologetic about the kidnapping. He said that they had a wonderful time and, quote, "It was 6 days of being in like a trance. It was so wonderful. It was great to be with my daughter again," end quote. So not apologetic, definitely a crazy person. This was absolutely a roller coaster ride.
It really was. For somebody to take on so many different identities and to try to con so many different people. And it worked most of the time until he completely went over the edge and started committing crimes that could be tied back to him, or crimes that it didn't matter if you're a Rockefeller or not. If you kidnap your daughter, you're going to get in trouble. But obviously by this time, they found out that he was a fraud, and he is going to be in jail at least for 7 more years. So hoping that that parole does not happen due to the murder and the kidnapping, I would love to see him spend the rest of his life in prison. And I think that's the closest we're going to get to justice in this case.
Yeah, I think you're right. Man, this one is a crazy one. So I'm glad we're done with it.
It was. Thanks, McKenzie, for bringing this to our attention, as it was very wild. It's kind of what would happen if Frank Abagnale was actually an idiot.
Yeah. All right, guys, we appreciate you for sticking around and for tuning in each and every week. We hope you continue to love the show. If you do, don't forget to stop over on iTunes and leave us a rating and a review.
We appreciate you guys. We'll be back on Friday with another True Crime to Go.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.